Blog Talk Radio.
Baruch Hashem, this is Mark Lichtenwalter. This is Fundamentally Mormon, and it is the 8th night of June 2018. Guest call-in number is 917-889-8827, and tonight we will be reading The Bible and the Taxman by Ogden Kraut. So we're just going to get right into the reading, and we'll just start with that right now. The Bible and the Taxman by Ogden Kraut. Taxes have existed since the establishment of the first government among men, but taxes can, like anything else, be just or unjust, beneficial or abusive, and the line between them is difficult to recognize. The Bible, as usual, is a textbook, even for the interesting and sometimes controversial subject. From the first book of the Bible, in almost its first chapter, we discover the words, "And thou shalt rule over him," as part of the issue of government between Cain and Abel. This was only a government between two young men. However, Cain was warned that if he did well, it would be acceptable, but if not, sin would come knocking at his door. This was to become a precedent for individuals and governments forever after. And in every succeeding generation, when men have sought to develop a system of government, a revenue agent was usually there, either as Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde. Page 2. So we're reading pamphlets by Ogden Kraut, which you can find to read for yourself at ogdenkraut.com. And then just go to book availability and go down to pamphlets. It's in alphabetical order. This is the second pamphlet in that book of pamphlets that was compiled by Ogden Kraut and then later compiled on the internet for people to read by Beverly. So we thank her for that. Anywhere on page 2, Joseph the Revenue Man. Throughout history, there was never a more beloved taxman than Joseph in Egypt. Although he was a foreigner in a strange land and a welfare case of the lowest form, he rose to gain the respect of every nation of the world. A grievous depression was about to befall the world, but Joseph's wisdom and inspirational foresight would prove equal to the problem. Joseph's plan was good in the eyes of the Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants, for which he was raised to the highest position of public trust. He not only became president of the Egyptian Federal Reserve Bank and the head of the Department of Agriculture, but he was a national director of the Internal Revenue Service. And the Pharaoh added, "According unto thy word shall all my people be ruled." Quite a position for a lad of only 30 years old. Without a diploma from Harvard University nor any degree in law, this young man was going to attempt to rule the world. Joseph's first step in solving the nation's problem was to impose a 20% tax. This has a very familiar and dull ring in our own ears, but his program was entirely different, both in principle and in purpose. His 1040 form consisted of a one-fifth tax, see Genesis chapter 41, verse 34, to be equally shared by everyone. The rich would find no tax-exempt foundations nor corporate trusts. Neither were there any technical loopholes to leave the middle-class workers to bear the burden on April 15th. Joseph's Federal Reserve Bank, dissimilar to those of today, was filled with corn rather than gold. Furthermore, it would be returned to the taxpayers in the time of a depression. His bank was established for the purpose of rehabilitating the destitute. Rather than foreclosure, repossession, confiscation, and eviction, this taxation, though seemingly heavy, was imposed during the plenteous years, as a trust against the forthcoming lean years. This was a tax for the preservation of the people and a reconstruction of the nation during grievous times. Joseph didn't allow any tax money for a multitude of governmental departments, agencies, or commissions. It was peculiarly simple. Joseph's tax system was imposed upon all. Page 3. Upon all the people, except the land of the priests only. See Genesis chapter 47, verse 26. Hence, the only exempt or tax-exempt status enjoyed by anyone were those involved in the rites of religion. This was a wise and important regulation for a multitude of reasons. Too numerous to mention, or for a multitude of reasons too numerous to mention here. But it was to be observed throughout biblical history by good governments, and even some that were bad. Finally, the years of plenty were ended, and the dearth was in all the lands. We read that, quote, all countries came into Egypt to Joseph to buy corn, because that the famine was so sore in all the lands. See Genesis chapter 1, verse 57. Four nations were crying for foreign aid. Did Joseph believe in huge giveaway programs? Was the taxpayers' money to be used to fatten the treasury of aliens? The famine continued even after they had spent all their money for food, but Joseph refused to give them the taxpayers' food. It reads in the Bible that Joseph said, quote, give your cattle and I will give you bread. And they brought their cattle to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for flocks and for cattle of the herds and for the asses, and he fed them with bread for their cattle, and he fed them with bread for all the cattle of that year. Genesis chapter 4, verse 17. Actually, that's not right. I think it's supposed to be 54. That's a typo here. Maybe it's 44. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll continue on. But the famine continued. The next year, the ambassador of many nations came to plead again, but their money was gone, their cattle were gone, and there is aught left but our bodies and our lands, they cried. It was a very pitiful plea, enough to touch the heart of anyone. Would Joseph give away his people's tax money now? No. Joseph made them an offer, and they sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them. So the land became Pharaoh's, and the people became his servants. Then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have brought you this day, and I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. But the people did not complain. Rather, they were grateful and replied, thou hast saved our lives, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. Joseph became a conqueror of nations, yet he never declared war, nor did he even fire a shot. Indeed, he gained the highest admiration and respect from everyone. This young man, who was sold as a slave by his brothers, and that's not true, he wasn't sold by the slave. It's kind of funny, everybody, I know, tangents, I go on tangents all the time, but if you go back to the account, like, his brothers threw him in the pit, and they were talking to the Ishmaelites to sell him, but then came a band of Midianites and found him in the hole, and they stole him, and they sold him in Egypt. So his brothers, they were talking to the Ishmaelites about selling him, but they didn't. The Midianites stole Joseph from the pit that his brothers put him in. Oh, I get a kick out of that because everybody reads right over that. They all, you know, every sermon I've ever heard about Joseph in Egypt and all that, they say his brothers sold him, and it's just not true. His brothers didn't. Were talking to the Ishmaelites, but the Midianites actually stole him. All right, this young man who was sold as a slave by his brothers and put into prison by the Egyptians said, "They thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to save much people alive." Page 4. We should inquire in our heads the state of the... We should inquire in our heads of state the same question asked by Pharaoh. Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? Genesis chapter 41, verse 38. For surely in our day we need one. Israel's taxmen, good guys and bad. Many succeeding generations of both nations and individuals rose and fell, but only a few preserved their respectability. Usually governments, like our television cowboys, would exchange their white hats for the black ones. Too often men who acquired great power and riches were still faced with the problem of temptation. Regardless of how numerous their flocks and herds, or the degree of their royalty and riches, they were always tempted to take property and freedom from others. This vicious business of grafting and greed was noted by wise old Solomon, who declared that he that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 10. The 12 tribes of Israel were often overtaxed by their own leaders, but after their separation, they became the victims of terrible and oppressive foreign taxes. The misery they suffered, however, was the result of their own frailties. Samuel the prophet religiously led the Israelites in freedom and prosperity until they cried to have a ruler like the other nations. Jehovah told Samuel that if they did, they would be rejecting him. Nevertheless, they could have a ruler according to their desire. Samuel warned the Israelites that their new president would levy a 10% tax on their lands and sheep, and their sons would become soldiers and their daughters be servants, and even their asses would be in the king's service. But in spite of all the warnings, the people refused to obey the voice of the prophet Samuel. And they did say, "Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all other nations." 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 19 and 20. But bitter water can be known only by its taste. And the Israelites soon tasted the tax system that would pucker their purse for many generations to come. The Israelites got their worldly leader and the graduated income tax that came with him. His revenues, like the coils of a snake, squeezed out their freedom and their property. Page 5. Finally, in an appeal to the son of one of their leaders, they asked for lower taxes, but Rehoboam, their leader, responded, "My father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke." Rehoboam sent Adoram, his tax collector, out to grab all the greenbacks. But the Israelites responded by having a Boston Tea Party in his honor. Since there was no tea nor any harbor, they did the next best thing. All Israel stoned him with stones that he die. 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 18, and 2 Chronicles chapter 10, verse 18. Rehoboam got the message and quickly saddled up and rode off into the sunset. Another rascal soon appeared in the presidential chair named Menahem. He reigned 10 years over Israel, but he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and he made Israel to sin. His length of public service is confined to 2 verses in the Bible. They described his bribe with the king of Assyria for 1,000 talents of silver that his hand might be with him to confirm the kingdom in his hand. And Menahem exacted the money of Israel, 2 Kings chapter 15, verses 19 through 20, for collecting money from his people and buying favors from foreigners. We read that Menahem slept with his fathers in the local graveyard. Similarly, another scamp named Jehoiakim exacted the silver of the gold of the people of the land to give it unto Pharaoh. So he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, according to all that his fathers had done. 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 37. The result of giving Israel's tax money to foreigners was that Jehovah sent the Chaldeans, the Syrians, the Moabites, and the Amorites against Judah, and Jehoiakim was buried with his fathers. It was because of these many financial miscarriages that the Israelite incorporated a solemn truth into their sacred writings, which read, "In the house of the righteous is much treasure, but in the revenue of the wicked is trouble." Proverbs 15, verse 6. It was a sorrowful lesson that Israelites could learn over and over again. After the unity among the tribes of Israel became dissolved, the Israelites were subject to many foreign taxes. The Assyrians were quick to tax Judah and Israel. Kings chapter 16, verse 8. And later Judah made the foolish mistake of displaying their wealth to the envoy from Babylon. Jehovah's warning had been that they should see it carried into Babylon, page 6. And nothing shall be left, 2 Kings chapter 20, verses 14 through 17. Sure enough, they did. Judah's taxes evolved to become an excruciating purse of pain, and they wailed, "We have borrowed money for the king's tribute from our lands and vineyards, but an evil tax collector knows neither mercy nor repentance. Their philosophy is that a little tax is good, so a lot of tax should be better." The poor Judeans suffered not only debt from taxation, but they mourned, quote, We bring into bondage our sons and daughters to be servants. Neither is it in our power to redeem them. Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 5. How amazing that our tax system today could be patterned after an antiquated system nearly 3,000 years old. How did Nehemiah, the ancient prophet of God, handle this aggravating situation? When he heard the howls of these agonized victims of financial oppression, he said, quote, "I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury, and I set a great assembly against them." Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 3 through 7. Hold on here. Just going to check and make sure there's no callers on the studio. The phone number, if anybody does want to call in to talk after I'm done reading this portion, the guest call-in number is 917-889-8827, and I'll take any phone calls. But let's finish this this portion here. The old prophet, Nehemiah, was a tax fighter. Sometimes the tables were turned. When wise old Solomon became king, he conquered other nations and appointed a tribute from his captives for the construction of the temple and a wall around Jerusalem. The contributors were the Amorites, Hittites, Pezerites, Hebetites, and Jebusites, which were not of the children of Israel. See 1 Kings chapter 9. Verses 20 and 21, 2 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 11. This was a system of taxation that should have been preserved. When any nation made war on another nation and lost, they would have to pay taxes. It would make every warlike people think twice about formulating any wars, because if they lost, they would become slaves or servants. If such a tax program would have been implemented after World War I, there would have been no World War II, and certainly everyone would have been pleased for the peaceful condition. This tax practice also existed in the days of Joshua, for it was written that the Canaanites dwell among the Ephraimites unto this day and serve under tribute. Joshua chapter 17, verse 25. It was known to exist even in the days of Jesus. For when Jesus asked of Peter, of whom did the kings of the earth take custom or tribute, of their own children or of strangers? Peter answered and saith unto him, of strangers. The Lord once warned, on page 7, the Lord once warned the revenue agents that your treading is upon the poor, and you take from him burdens of wheat. So he promised that their houses built of hewn stone would be desolate, and ye have planted pleasant vineyards, but ye shall not drink the wine of them. Amos chapter 5, verse 11. Then again, reminding them that taxes were not to be imposed upon the poor, he said, O ye that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, I will turn your feasts into mourning, and all your songs into lamentation, and the end thereof as a bitter day. Amos chapter 8, verses 4 and 10. These shrewd rulers had accompanied his affliction upon the poor by creating inflation. They made the ephah small and the shekel great. Amos chapter 8, verse 5. Great Scott! They also had international bankers. We had watched in our own country the international devaluation of the American dollar and the rise of the Russian ruble. Daniel, another ancient prophet, warned the people of the king of Persia, who would be a raiser of taxes. But God was provoked by his nefarious deed and explained to Daniel that within a few days he shall be destroyed. Daniel chapter 11, verse 20. And accordingly, the raiser of taxes meant his eternal destination. Church and state segregation. Throughout biblical history, priests or ministers of God have usually been tax exempt. Artaxerxes, king of Persia, once wrote to Ezra, the priest, and verified the civil law by saying, also we certify you that touching any of the priests and Levites, singers, porters, Nethinims, I don't even know what that is, or ministers of this house of Jehovah, it shall not be lawful to impose toil, tribute, or customs upon them. Ezra chapter 7, verse 24. This restriction was honored by most nations, and when it wasn't, they were overthrown or obliterated. When the number of ministers diminishes, the nation is weakened. The taxmen may think that there are too many ministers, but Moses didn't. He wished that all Jehovah's people were prophets, and that Jehovah would put his spirit upon them. Numbers chapter 11, verse 29. However, the state has often ruled over churches, and on occasion, church has governed the government. Page 8. The healthiest atmosphere has always been where there is a separation of church and state, but too often the state has demanded revenue from the church, creating a very perilous risk to the instigators of such usurpation. And to the religious atmosphere of the nation. On the other hand, we have witnessed that the barbarity that has often fallen to a people who lived under a government that was totalitarian towards theology. Oftentimes, wholesale slaughter has been occurred or has occurred by church state. It was Jesus, or Yeshua, his Hebrew name, who warned that the time cometh that whoever killeth you will think that he doeth God a service. John chapter 16, verse 2. The Bible's weather prophet, Malachi, also forecasted the day of burning, which was going to burn up the wicked and leave them with neither root nor branch. Why would they become ashes under his feet, or under the feet of the righteous? Because they had robbed Jehovah. And Jehovah explained this by saying, quote, "But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings." Malachi chapter 3, verse 8. If money given to a church is taken by the state under any pretense, then the government is robbing the churches of their tithes and offerings. This was the awesome warning and conclusion of the Old Testament. But the ancient prophet Isaiah gives us some hope for the future. Okay, we got 60 seconds left on the program. Now what's going to happen after that 60 seconds is up, anybody who is listening will be cut off unless they call into the radio show. We're going into overdrive, and the guest call-in number, and if you just want to listen, that's fine, but the guest call-in number is 917-889-8827. That's 917-889-8827, and we've got 38 seconds left of the live streaming portion of the radio program. So I'll just continue to read. If there's anybody who does call in, if you push one, if you have any questions, I'll bring you on air. Otherwise, you can just listen, and that's fine. Let's see. But the ancient prophet Isaiah gives us some hope for the future. More than any other prophet of the Old Testament, he looked to the end of the world and saw that after the destructions came upon it, that a beautiful city in Zion would be built, and that would come to the millennial reign of peace and prosperity to the world. Let me get a drink there. Sorry about that. When marveling at this beautiful and magnificent condition on the earth, he inquired, "Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver?" Isaiah chapter 33, verse 18. He was inferring that in that day there will be no taxman or revenue agent. Christ and the Roman revenues. Caesar Augustus of the Roman Empire and some of our Washington bureaucrats have one thing in common. The foundation of their political pyramid was created by a conglomerate maze of taxes. Caesar became so enthusiastic over taxation that he believed all the world should be taxed. Luke chapter 2, verse 1. In this illusion, he imposed a property tax, an animal tax, a grain tax, a wine tax, a vehicle tax, a road tax, an import and export tax, a salt tax, and an income tax, and even an emergency tax. Sound familiar? Furthermore, most of the tax collectors went to Rome, their Washington, D.C., where it was doled out by a federal welfare system to the Roman citizens who were too lazy to work. Into this labyrinth of confusion, Christ was born. But he experienced the misery of taxation even before his birth. His pregnant mother was being transported across Judea to Bethlehem for a poll tax, which was really a registration program to make people eligible for taxation. Part of this peculiar regulation required everyone to return to their place of their birth, which created a massive population shuffle. Each person was required to pay a specific amount of money, and a special coin was minted called tribute money. See Matthew chapter 22, verse 17, and Mark chapter 12, verse 14. Another strange tax imposed by the Romans was a temple tax. This was to be paid by all Jewish males over 20 years of age and was used by both the Romans and the Jews to rebuild the temple at Jerusalem. However, when these two nations went to war with each other in 70 AD, the temple was destroyed, but not the temple tax. The money was merely rerouted to Rome, where it was used to build a Roman temple. Roman tax collectors, excuse me, Roman tax collectors operated on a rather unusual system, which provided for an open-ended commission. Everything collected over the amount of the taxes due and was pocketed. It was a lucrative business with a 5-year contract and was always sold to the highest bidder. The local taxman was normally a villain whose object was to overcharge the citizens and underpay the government. Those who became tax collectors were usually despised by everyone and were called publicans. The publican system of taxation was a vicious one, and it often resulted in extortion as hush money, see Luke 19:8, and overcharging whenever possible, see Luke 13:13. These publicans or tax collectors often ransacked homes and businesses, demanding personal or company business files. It was considered the basis of all occupations and the strong feeling of many Jews to the absolute unlawfulness of paying tribute at all made matters worse, and accordingly, publicans of the New Testament were regarded as traitors and apostates, defiled by their frequent intercourse with the heathen and willing tools of the oppressor. Smith's Dictionary of the Bible, page 543, or on page 10. Neither did Jesus or Yeshua speak well of these publicans or revenue agents, for he classed them with the harlots, Matthew 18, verse 17, and with sinners, Matthew 11, verse 19, and with heathen men, Matthew 18, verse 17. When the publicans came to Yeshua to be baptized, they asked, "What shall we do?" Jesus was quick to reply, "Exact no more than that which is appointed you," Luke chapter 3, verse 13. Then when Jesus, or Yeshua, composed a parable about the publican and the Pharisee, he described the prayer of the Pharisees as saying, "God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican," Luke 18, verse 13. Later, as Yeshua walked into the multitude of people along the seaside, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the receipt of customs, and he said unto him, "Follow me." And he arose up and followed him. See Mark chapter 2, verse 14. This was not only an unusual situation, but also a critical one, because the scribes and Pharisees could not fathom that a man like Christ would ever be seen eating and drinking with publicans and sinners. Jesus replied that they that are sick need a physician. Then one day, a tax man of little stature named Zacchaeus came to see Jesus, even though he had to climb a tree to do it. He was a very particular revenue man because of his honesty. He even boasted that, "If I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I will restore him fourfold." Luke chapter 19, verses 1 through 10. What a tax man. Even Jesus responded by saying, "This day is salvation come to this house." Jesus and his apostles were exempt from taxes, and they often carried a purse and handled sums of money. Judas was their acting treasurer. Even though they were usually poor, with only a few pennies among them, they too soon learned that a cent can, and often does, carry a cent to some tax collectors. Eventually, Christ's apostles were called to a Roman audit, and one of the first questions was, "Doth your master pay tribute?" Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. This was part of the sacred tactic, and Peter, being unsure, tried to cooperate by saying, "Yea." Satisfied, the publicans left. But when Yeshua, or Jesus, heard this report, he was aggravated. However, the obligation had been made, so there was no backing out. They would have to pay, lest we should offend them. Peter got into that mess, so he was obligated to bail them out, go down to the sea, cast and hook, Peter was told, and if fish would provide, page 11, the money for the tax. When he was found in the mouth of the fish, a very peculiar place for tax money. But sometimes it requires money from strange places to cough up enough to pay the taxes. The subject of taxes was always an issue with Christ, as it is with most other mortals, and it became one of the principal reasons for his final persecution. The overrighteous Pharisees were jealous of Jesus and took counsel on how they might entangle him in his talk. And to do so, they brought some Herodians. Now, the Herodians were socially, if not religiously, akin to the Judeans, but their political allegiance was to Rome. Confronted Jesus by asking, "Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?" Matthew chapter 22, verse 17. If he answered negatively, the Herodians could take him to jail for tax rebellion. But the nature of the question, it is evident that Jesus had previously spoken against the Roman taxation. Neither would they have bothered to bring the Herodians as arresting officers unless they anticipated using them in their plot to trap Jesus. The scriptures inform us that Jesus perceived their wickedness, so he gave them an answer they could not refute. "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things which are God." Matthew chapter 22, verse 21. This answer provided for and acknowledged the clean separation between church and state, but God and politicians never have had much in common. Caesar's tribute money belonged to the government, and God's tithes and offerings belong to the church. A church has no right to take tax money, and a government has no right to take tithing money. A church needs no federal support money, and certainly church money is not intended to finance the government bureaucracy. If such a condition of mixing religion and politics should ever exist, then the people would have both a moral and legal right to refuse paying taxes and tithes. It was just as wrong for the church to collect money from the government as it is for the government to collect money from the church. The Pharisees were not content with Christ's irrefutable answer, nor were they happy with their failure to convict him, but they persisted in trying to acquire some kind of evidence against him, either religious or political. It was little more difficult in those days because the ancient tax collectors didn't have sophisticated machinery, computerized readouts, telephone wiretapping, or microfilming private bank accounts. But their devious dedication towards conviction in the courts was just the same. Finally, they were able to conspire with Judas, a dishonest banker, whose sticky fingers had already made too many withdrawals from the church's account, John chapter 12, verse 6. So for 30 pieces of silver, Judas sold out his best friend. My, how the lust for money can canker men in the highest religious and political offices. So they somehow managed, as tax men do, to find an error, and suppose error, even with Jesus Christ. The multitude of officers came to arrest the Prince of Peace, or the Shar Shalom, and he responded, "Are ye come out against a thief with swords and staves? for to take me, and for many centuries ever afar, many good men would also experience similar arrests and threats by officers brandishing weapons and arms, for all for an audit of taxes. To Judge Pontius Pilate, they barked, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar." Luke 23, verse 2. They were accusing Christ of being a tax rebel. When Pilate heard their case, he realized he was caught between a rock and a hard and a cross. Fortunately, he found a loophole in their legal jurisprudence. So he sent the case to the Supreme Court of Herod, who questioned him in many words. But Jesus answered him nothing. Jesus was taking the Fifth Amendment. The evidence was weak, so Herod sent him back to Pilate's court. Pontius was dismayed, so he questioned Jesus again. "Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee?" But Jesus answered him never a word. However, he did remark to his followers, "If they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in a dry?" The prospects for things getting better were discouragingly dimmed. And persecuting attorneys, the best buy, so coarse conviction was almost certainty. I don't think I'm going to be getting through this whole thing. There's too much left to read here. I'm just going to have to say you can find this at ogdenkraut.com if you want to read the rest of it, and I'll try to finish the rest of it tomorrow. You know what? Yeah, I guess I'm just going to have to do away with this program. So anyway, thank you for listening. I only have 45 minutes on the program that I can actually do things, so I'm just going to end it now. Take care, everyone. Shabbat shalom. Have a good night. Goodbye.